Thank you. We're about to start the second block this morning. Our speaker is Mauro Mangione. He's a research scientist at Yale. He works with Hoytman. And he will talk about multi-scale harmonic analysis of graphs in Hoytman Corpora.
Thank you, Lianis. First of all, thank you for being here, and thanks Stefan for his great talk that is going to save me a lot of time and definitions, because now everybody that was at his talk knows about all the basic definitions about diffusion geometry. The work that I'm going to talk about is joint with several other people in the applied mathematics department at Yale, mainly, which are listed there. And in fact, there are other people that I'm collaborating with, but I don't have the space or time to talk about that work today. I wanted to have a kind of tutorial talk, and very basic, about building upon Stefan's talk and moving on to multi-scale aspects of diffusion geometries that we haven't touched upon almost at all. And The point of view is also going to be slightly different, mainly because of my mathematical background, which is in harmonic analysis. And I would like to make the point that this different point of view is valuable, and it gives a different, it allows you to have I think what are new ideas for analyzing data sets and functions on data sets. And the main consequence of this point of view would be that I will be talking a lot and almost only about functions and data sets. And I was very happy when yesterday David Marquette in his talk was saying, well, document space is really a space of mappings, and these mappings map the data set or the document corpus in some other space. Yes, but somehow pretty much the only way I can think about these kind of issues. And I'm going to give another talk in the math department in which I can indulge more in there. Harmonic analysis parts of all of these things, there are really beautiful connections with classical harmonic analysis, but really this is not there. These are only partially relevant for our purposes here. So these are pretty much the points that I wanted to touch upon in this talk. First of all, as I said, the focus is going to be on functions on data sets. That's pretty much any questions that we have about these data sets can be cast in terms of analyzing some functions or classes of functions on the data set, approximating them, denoising them, and then starting already using languages of similar to signal processing, if you want. And so I'm going to make connections with classical signal processing, like you can think of analyzing signals or images. These are functions of time or space, and here we're going to have functions on the graphs, on the point clouds that we're interested in. And signal processing evolved by starting, maybe, with Fourier analysis. And we will be talking how to generalize Fourier analysis, and we will realize that that's what Stefan has been doing in the past hour. So the eigenfunctions of Laplacian are the natural generalization of Fourier analysis on graphs and manifolds. And then, so I'm not going to spend much time on that since already seen a lot of material regarding that. I will just re-mention them from a slightly different point of view. And then I'm going to move on to multi-scale analysis. There was a transition also in signal processing and in harmonic analysis from global Fourier analysis, which involves global functions which have global support, they're supported everywhere, to local and multi-scale basis elements. And this was a crucial transition in signal processing and harmonic analysis and it yielded really powerful tools, both in theory and in applications. In theory, for analyzing interesting classes of operators, and in applications for getting really, say, good denoising, good compression algorithms that are the state of the art today. Numerical analysis for these tools are the ones that allow the fast solution of PDEs and linear equations. And now we're at the documents. Well, there will be documents all along, small examples that will illustrate these ideas, and there will be the science news corpus, of course, as everyone was already expecting, and we will see what it means, what these multi-scale constructions mean in terms of documents and words and language. I'm not an expert in document corpora, but I would try to convince you that there is really an interesting meaning. So the first slide is about functions on the data. That's all we will be talking about. And you can think of the data as modeled as a point cloud in RM or as a graph. In reality, you can think of it as a rather general matrix space. I'm not going to go into the technical assumptions because in general, I don't know how to test them. In general, it's an expert that comes to me and says, well, this data set is modeled as, say, this matrix space or as this point cloud in RM or as this graph. And I claim that most of the questions that we want to ask about these data sets can be passed into questions about certain functions on this data set. Two examples. One example is what is called semi-supervised learning. It is the following. Suppose you have a large corpus of documents, and somebody went through the hard work of labeling some of these documents as being, say, sports documents or geography documents or science documents. Well, you can't label, I don't know how many billions of pages are now indexed, but several billions. So you label some of them. Say, go to the Yahoo directory and you have several thousands or even more labeled. Okay, but now you would like to infer the labels of other documents. And you can think that, say, if you look at all the documents that are labeled as sports documents, that's a function which is one on the documents which are labeled as sport documents, and it's zero elsewhere. And then you have another function, which is the characteristic functions of the documents about science, which is one on the documents which have been labeled as science, and it's zero elsewhere. So these functions which have been defined also in a very scattered part of the document, of a set of documents, and you would like to extend them or interpolate them in some way. So you want to smooth these functions or denoise them in some sense. It's like you're given sparse sampling and you want to guess what's in the middle of the sparse samples. And that's exactly what semi-supervised learning is about. So it's an interpolation problem under smoothness constraints, if you want. Or you can think that you have your own favorite web pages and you have the ones that you prefer the most and ones that you prefer the least. And so you have a function defined on a small subset of the web pages. What's this function? The web page X is telling you how much you like that page. And maybe I want to find out which are web pages you might like and how much you might like them in order to send you an email and say, go and visit web page, that web page. And again, this is again an interpolation problem because you have this function defined on a few web pages and you want to extrapolate it to new web pages. And most of the, and I think all of the learning problems can be cast into this framework. Any questions? Okay, so we've talked a lot in these past few days about parameterizations of data sets, embeddings of data sets, and sometimes with different names about features. But parameterization of data sets are, again, just functions of the set. Because what is a parameterization? Well, this can be a local or global parameterization, but it's mapping points from the data set to R, R, D, depending on how many parameters you're picking. So these, again, are functions of the set. And for example, the eigenfunctions of the Laplacians that we've talked about in several different talks provide, well, hopefully, rather large global parameterizations, as Stefan showed in some examples, or at least provably, as Peter Jones proved in his talk, local parameterization at an adequate scale on neighbors of the correct size. Now, why is it interesting to parameterize? Well, as the Farr remarked already in his talk, you hope that the parameterization allows you to discover what are the, I can say only parameters, what are the interesting factors that generate the data or that belong to the data. We have this picture in our minds of that oftentimes we measure too much about the data in a certain sense. We get this data in very high dimensions, but really the intrinsic dimensionality of these data sets is much lower. It's a low dimensional manifold or a low dimensional set in a much higher dimension. And parameterizing it allows you to find, oh, there are really just few parameters generating or parameterizing my data sets, I don't need all the others, and I can get maybe Euclidean pictures of my data sets by using these parameterizations and then work in Euclidean spaces. One would like, and this is a question that I don't know how to formulate mathematically, is that these parameterizations are useful for whichever question you have. And meaningful is something that I cannot meaningfully define mathematically. And it is sometimes the case that you can interpret these parameters as some physical parameters under generating the data set or some probabilistic parameter, but that's not always the case. Stefan showed some example in which you do have such a meaningful interpretation, but we have discussed in the past few days, like when you parameterize in some way by using, for example, principal components, these are usually global parameters, but for which we have no interpretation. Sometimes they might be meaningful, sometimes not. But this question is somehow very difficult to tackle mathematically because you can define meaningful. And we also talked about embeddings. That's almost the same thing as parameterizing, but I would say that the emphasis of parameterizing is discovering useful parameters of the data. When we talk about embeddings, we want something more quantitative about these parameterizations. We want to say, oh, we're mapping some neighborhood of a point to RD, and we are preserving the metric, or we are almost preserving the metric. So we have quantitative statements about the distortion of this map. So it's something more than parameterization. But parameterization could have a very large distortion. When we talk about embeddings, we want to put an emphasis on quantifying the amount of distortion given by certain parameterizations. And with Michael on the first day had a rather complete introduction to embeddings and metric embeddings and so on. And we will see more this afternoon in the Austrian Dick's talk. Now, so all these embeddings, all these parameterizations, when we talk about features of the data, all of these are functions of the set. So we need good ways for storing, compressing, denoising, for analyzing the functions on the sets. And one classical way of doing that is by having good basis functions on the sets. Observe here that the shift is, so we start from a data set, and usually we think we have these data sets in RD and we have the coordinates. These are the functions we care about. Now we're moving, and now we live on the data set, and we want basis functions on the data set. That's like putting coordinates on these data sets. Some coordinates are better than others. Think of having a sound, and you can store each the amplitude of a sound at every time. That's going to take a lot of memory. It's not going to be very instructive if you want to do denoising. Well, if you change coordinates in RN and say you write the signal in a Fourier basis or on a wavelet basis, suddenly tasks like denoising or compression becomes much, much easier. We would like to do similar things on data sets. So the talk is going to be about how do we construct good basis for analyzing and performing interpolation, denoising, compression of functions on data sets. And so everything here is linear. We're just doing a change of coordinate, not on the point cloud, as we've been talking about in these past few days, but on the set of functions on the point cloud. And all these expansions are linear. You can think of adding a set of basis elements, and then we call them psi k. And you expand a function that you're interested in, or some function that you want to extend, or some function that you want to process onto those basis functions. And the hope is that if you choose well your basis functions, all these tests are going to become much easier. It's like when you do dimensionality reduction, well, you want to say, I have this point cloud, and by the lower dimension, it's a Euclidean space, I can do stuff. Here it's going to be, oh, I have a complicated function on my data set. If instead of writing it as n numbers, I change coordinates, I say I write it onto a weather basis, then I drop to lower dimensions, this lower dimension, and I can work there and do some tasks in a much easier way. So given that Stefan gave such a nice introduction about Laplacian eigenfunction, I think I can go by with one slide about Fourier analysis. I really have to restrain myself here, but that's pretty much what I would be saying. So for analysis is more than 200 years, so at least. And we started by studying FPD, by studying the heat equation, and by observing that well, you can write this PDE in normal coordinates. So you have a heat diffusing, say, on a square plate, and you can code the heat at every time by saving its value at every point in the square. Or maybe you, instead of using this basis, which is the basis of delta functions, just storing the values of the function at every point, use a different basis, like the Fourier basis, you can actually solve the heat equation almost immediately. And that's because the Fourier basis is the basis of eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. The Laplacian is a walk over as the heat diffusion, and so if you write everything in terms of its eigenfunctions, the diffusion process becomes just a dilation in the space of functions when written in this basis, a diagonal dilation by the eigenvalues. Now, we've talked in these past few days about how free analysis can be generalized to manifolds and graphs. You look at the Laplacian, which is very naturally defined on manifolds and graphs. You look at its eigenfunctions. So phi k is going to be the name of the eigenfunctions, and lambda k is the corresponding eigenvalues. And these form an orthonormal basis. There is a very well-established theory of how these eigenfunctions look like, what they're orthogonal, and so on. And you can analyze functions on by using these Fourier models. And you can do some manifolds that are on graphs. Now, there are good things and bad things. We've seen several good things in the past few days from the point of view of these numerical computations that I wanted to add, but in very special cases, in the interval, on the square, and in a few other cases, you have very fast algorithms for computing the expansion of a function onto this Fourier basis. This is the celebrated FFT, which is Peter, who says not 40 years old, but it's
also 200 years old.
201 years old.
201 years old.
And which, unfortunately, we don't know how to do that in general, but in very special cases, we know how to do that. So one drawback of free analysis, as I very briefly mentioned before, is that it's a global analysis. These functions, think of sine kx, are supported in the whole square. The same thing happens on manifolds and graphs. These eigenfunctions are supported everywhere. So this is all perfectly fine if you're analyzing a function which is moved everywhere. Then analyzing it local, analyzing it global, it doesn't make a big difference because the function is uniformly smooth everywhere. But now if the function is not uniformly smooth everywhere, it's smooth in some region and not in some other, well, you wanna discover that. But if you're analyzing basis elements that are spread everywhere, then they're not gonna be able to distinguish very easily. They're gonna mix information from locations where the function is really smooth and where it's not. And this information is going to be mixed up, and now if you want to do things like denoising and compression, it cannot be optimal. And this was recognized very early in the engineering community by Gabor, for example, who was looking at Fourier analysis for compressing sound, for example, and he said, we need to localize. And we will be talking about that, and how one can localize, and we will make comparisons between localization and non-localization. Now, we have talked just very little about the Lie kernel of manifolds, and this is just one slide to make a connection with Peter's talk, and I really don't have the time to go into more detail here, but the Laplacian is a differential operator, so it might seem odd to define such a thing on a graph. So some people really prefer to think of it in terms of its connections with random walks and heat diffusion, and the connection is very simple. You have the heat kernel, which is defined as operator exponentiations of the Laplacian, and this heat kernel really represents the diffusion of heat. And the eigenfunctions of the Laplacians are also the eigenfunctions of the heat kernel, just by the spectral theorem. And the eigenvalues just get also exponentiated. That's exactly the spectral theorem. And so studying the eigenfunctions of the heat kernel is the same thing as studying the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian, and that's why they're connected to the heat diffusion. And we've already talked about diffusion maps, so I'm not going to say more about those. On graphs, where everything is discrete, and I think we saw these definitions also in, well, a slightly different one, maybe, in Stefan's talk, what do? You have a discrete graph. We assume that the graph is weighted. And we want to define a random graph on this graph. Well, it seem, if you think that the way to measure the similarity between two nodes, it seems very reasonable to say that the probability of jumping from node I to node j should be proportional to the similarity between node I and node j. And so the matrix W is encoding these weights. Unfortunately, this does not define a random walk because it's not normalized correctly. You normalize it correctly by simply summing the weights for each vertex and dividing that out, so you get an actual Markov process. And you look at an L2 version of that process, and you define the normalized Laplacian in this fashion. And you have an associated heat kernel, which is a formula which is still generated by the Laplacian. So this e to the minus t Laplacian really means it's the same group generated by the Laplacian, but describes the heat diffusion of the graph. And sometimes these graphs are discretization of manifolds, discretizations of points coming from dynamical systems. There could be a whole talk about these connections, actually. And the only point that I wanted to make is that when you do have a model that generates the data, and when, at least for two kinds of models, the graph is a sample manifold, or the graph comes from a discretized dynamical system of some type that I don't want to discuss, then this graph Laplacian or some of its variations actually approximate the continuous counterparts, the continuous Laplacian of the manifold or some differential operator that was driving the dynamical system. This is the second point is what Stefan was alluding to when he showed that molecular dynamics simulations. And one missing piece, but we have already talked about this in the past few days, is how do we associate a graph with a data set? Sometimes the data set is already presented to you in the form of the graph, for example, the web graph discussed yesterday afternoon and so on. In some other cases, the data sets could be just a bunch of points in Rn or a bunch of points in a matrix space. And we've seen how, in some cases, we can associate a graph to the set of points. The main idea here, and I don't want to say too much about this because Stefan already explained it in the previous talk, is to declare that two points are connected and similar only when they're extremely close in this matrix space. So if this is a cloud of points in Rn, you for example, have the Euclidean distance, you weight that in a way which is inversely proportional to the distance, and you put an edge between two points which are really close, and you put no edge between points which are far away. The main idea being that, I know how to declare that two documents are very close to each other. I have no idea what it means for two documents to be far away. I mean, I know that they're far away, but I don't know how to quantify that. So I shouldn't be forced to define a distance between those points. And so define local similarities. This defines a graph in which every point is connected to a few other points that represent very similar points, and then diffuse. And these are some examples. I think Stefan already mentioned these. When the point clouds are in Rn, you can pick similarities, for example, given by these functions. Everybody's familiar with those. And all of them decay with a certain, when the similarity is not large enough. And let me just summarize what we've seen also in the past few days from the point of view of thinking of these functions as functions on the set. So they provide embeddings, the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian provide embeddings for the data set. And Michael, during the first day in his tutorial talk, he showed the connection. This is just a kernelized version of MDS, where the matrix space that we have is the one not with geodesic distances, but with this kind of diffusion distances. And we've seen in Peter's talk that one can prove, at least for domains in Rn and manifolds, that these eigenfunctions, when picked correctly on the correct neighbors, provide very nice coordinate charts that are blowing up the neighbor to a universal size domain inside the unit ball. And in some cases, surprisingly enough, these eigenfunctions actually provide good coordinates on much larger neighbors, but we don't know how to prove them. And also, as Stefan discussing his talk, and also Andrew Thomas yesterday talked about in a slightly different language, you can study large time diffusion simply by projecting onto the top eigenfunctions. You get a faithful representation of the diffusion for very large time, and you can study that. Mr. Nitz have been used by several different people on completely different data sets. And this seemed very robust, and we even now have some quantitative theorems about these things are really robust. But just to give an idea, it has been used for image segmentations, it has been used for building classifiers in a semi-supervised setting, and now also just in a supervised setting. And it has been applied to our data, hyperspectral data, molecular dynamics simulations, as we saw in the previous talk, and text document classifications, as also we saw in the previous talk. So just one picture, for example. This is a picture of an hyperspectral image. An hyperspectral image is an image. It's a set of images, each one capturing photons at different frequencies. And so you have a stack of images, each of them representing how many photons you collected that were at a certain frequency of light. And we're doing some hyperspectral pathology in the applied group at Yale. And now you can view each pixel as having a whole spectrum, the response to different frequencies. And you can think of that as a set of documents. The spectra that we collect are 128 dimensional vectors. Each picture has about 1 million such spectra. And this is a cloud of 1 million points in 128 dimensions. And you want to understand the structure of this cloud, or parameterize it, or look at functions of this cloud. One such function could be, for example, is the spectrum of a nucleus or not? Now you can think of a function which is one of the nuclei spectra, and it's zero elsewhere. And you want to learn this function, you want to approximate it. And what I'm plotting here is an RGB image where, well, let me say one more thing. So when I compute an eigenfunction on this point cloud, it's a function on this point cloud, but now each point in the cloud was a spectrum, so it would be corresponding to a pixel. So each eigenfunction is actually an image. Okay? And so what I'm doing here, I'm mapping the values of the first eigenfunctions to blue, the values of the second eigenfunctions to red, and the value of the third eigenfunction to green. And I'm representing this in an sRGB image. And what I get is a meaningful, this time, segmentation, completely unsupervised, of the data that I was looking at. Blue actually are nuclei, and green is cytoplasma, and red is something outside of cytoplasma. And it's mainly fat and proteins. So strange sets of documents. And this is the picture that I already showed you a couple of days ago, and we saw pretty much the same picture as Stefan's talk. This is the Science News documents. I'm going to talk about this because it's going to come up at the end when I do the multi-scale discussion, so that's why I'm showing it again. The data set was a 1,000 by 2,000 matrix where the entry IJ is the frequency of word J in document I. The dictionary of words was fixed once for all. And I define similarity by saying that two documents are very similar is the most salient words in each document if they share the most salient words. It's essentially a threshold of the correlation coefficients between the word frequencies. Nothing fancy, I'm not an expert of document corpora anyway. So. And here I'm mapping down this potentially 10,000 dimensional data set, but nobody here I think believes it. It was truly 10,000 dimensional. In fact, it couldn't be more than 1,000 dimensional since I only had 1,000 points. Into three dimensions by using the eigenfunctions, and we see that certain relationships between the groups, which are represented by different colors and were given to me together with the data, stay pretty well separated, except that some of them which have good reasons for not being separated, like anthropology and biology. And I'm going to skip the example about molecular dynamics, even if it's very interesting. Stefan has already said, has already talked about a similar example, so so I'd rather tell you why Fourier analysis has limitations, which I described before. If you're analyzing a function which is uniformly nice, uniformly smooth, no problem. If you have functions which change behavior from region to region, then you do have trouble if you want to do Fourier analysis. It mixes up information coming from different regions. And in David Marquette's words, document space is an elephant. What he meant by that, at least if you want my interpretation of that, is that we have functions which can be very wide on these data sets. We cannot expect to analyze them with nice global elements that can detect only global smoothness. We need to be adaptive, we need to be much smarter about how we analyze these functions. And what's the remedy? Well, let's try to localize the Fourier basis. But now it comes to the next question, which is how much do you want to localize it? I mean, even for sound, you can imagine you have a sound and you want to represent efficiently this sound. Well, you can start saying, oh, let me pick a window this size and let me do Fourier analysis in the window and let me translate the window. Okay, so you have localized, but now, inside that window, the function could have two different behaviors and you're mixing them inside that window. And so you say, oh, I should pick a smaller window, but no, because maybe the function in a large region is uniformly smooth and you can compress it very well with a large window, and then in other regions, the function is much wider and so you need a very small window. So one size of window doesn't work. And adapting it, it's not easy. And this is one of the many a posteriori reasons why wavelet analysis was developed and why it works so well on at least low dimensional signals. Wavelet bases don't have one scale, they have all scales. So in one dimension, what is a wavelet basis? You pick a function, you translate it, it's compactly supported, nicely compactly supported, you translate it, and you dilate it by all factors of two. So when you expand on such a basis, you're able to detect all transient behaviors of the signals at all scales at different locations, independently. These wavelets, a wavelet at this scale here is not going to talk to a wavelet over there. If the function is very smooth over here, you can use relatively fat wavelets to compress it very well. If the function is much more complicated in another location, use finer wavelets and you compress automatically in an adaptive way. And they've been extremely successful for at least 1, 2, and 3D analysis. They led to very fast numerical schemes for solving PDEs. The state-of-the-art solvers and integral equations are also based on, at least a class of them is based on wavelets, and it's absolutely state-of-the-art. So they've been extremely useful. Now, they've been mostly restricted to low-dimensional Euclidean settings. I say mostly because there's been work by several mathematicians in trying to extend this framework. Nobody has really extended it to the situation of general graphs and manifolds. And manifolds, there have been some constructions, but they're rather low dimensionals. And graphs, well, when you try to extend the concept of translating and dilating on a graph, you immediately run into trouble because you say, well, in R, it's pretty clear what it means to dilate, and the same is clear in Rn. On a manifold, maybe I can think about some way of inducing local dilations, but on a graph, I lack any symmetry structure that allows me to dilate and have multiple scales. So how are we going to do that? I really wanted to do this if I just had time to. This compares the wavelet analysis and the Fourier analysis of a signal with one just simple discontinuity. But I couldn't get it into my PowerPoint. I fought hard and then I gave up. And so let's see. It might be this one. Oh yes, now I remember. Sorry. Maybe I just give up. Oh yes, there it is. So I pick a very simple function. It's a function which is linear and it has one discontinuity at one point. You will say, oh, but this function is trivial. I will need very few bits to encode this function because I just need to know that it's a line. I say it's where it starts and what's the slope. And then I need to save the location of the discontinuity and I'm done. Well, yeah. Well, you're doing a lot of work here, yeah. But you say this should be highly compressible. Now, what happens when you do a Fourier analysis of that? this is often, but as bad as when I try to put this into PowerPoint. So the x-axis indexes the Fourier coefficients or the Wheeler coefficients. The y-axis indexes magnitude, and the red line is the set of Fourier coefficients, so how they decay. They decay extremely slowly. If you want to get an order one, this is a log plot. If you want to get an order one approximation, you need something like more than 200 coefficients, say. If you do a Weber expansion, essentially by the time you have about half of the coefficients that you will need for Fourier, you're done. You have 10 digits of precision. Why? Because the Weberts exist at different scales. Weberts which are at a large scale completely compress the linear part. That's very easy to compress. And then you have a few wavelets that focus on the discontinuity, and once they're done, here, that's it. You have 10 digits of precision. And I mean, the difference is shocking. And this, if you think about these characteristic functions of documents about science, this is one such function. I mean, it's one here, and then it drops to zero. And so it's continuous. Yes?
Which wavelets is used here?
It doesn't matter.
Linear wavelets should work better than hard, right?
Oh yeah, so here they had at least, the only thing that matters here that they have at least one vanishing moment, okay. Essentially. So that the linear part really vanishes very quickly, and that's it. I use some WP probably 4 or 6, something like that. Who closed my presentation? Okay, so you see, even functions which have very mild non-uniformities in their smoothness are very hard to approximate by using Fourier basis, and if you use a multiscale basis, things are much better. I mean, it's not just a multiscale, wavelets are other properties that guarantee that, like see the vanishing moments, but I really don't have the time to go through that. And so how can we build this kind of wavelet basis on data sets? Well, what are the ingredients? We need to take some function, translate and dilate. That would be the classical idea. Well, we cannot dilate, do dilations on the graph. We could do this on other very specific spaces, but none of these spaces would be a model which is even close to any of the kind of data sets that we want to work on. And moreover, you know, if we try to use any possible symmetry on the data set, even supposing that we have that, well, there is noise in these data sets. So these data sets are always fuzzy. There is stochastic noise moving them. And so those will completely destroy the symmetry. So we shouldn't rely about any symmetries. And the idea is that, instead of thinking about dilating the space, let's just think about dilating the functions. And we're going to use diffusion as a dilation on the functions. We know, and we have now actually very quantitative results about how stable the diffusion is when you perturb the data set with noise. And we know that it is stable. And so let's use that as our starting point. And let's use that to dilate functions. Now, we've seen this slide in Stefan's talk. And now I'm going to draw a parallel that I think would be very instructive between what he was describing as k-means in spectral classing and the construction that I'm going to describe. So observation number one is that, let's call T essentially the heat kernel is normalized in a slightly different way. And let's assume that the spectrum of the heat kernel decays. So these are the eigenvalues sorted in decreasing order for T, the heat kernel. What does this assumption mean? So if the spectrum did not decay at all, we would have a graph in which every point is connected to every body S. I don't know what to say about that graph. I don't know how to analyze it, and probably it doesn't make sense. It's two worst cases. Everybody is connected to everybody S in exactly the same way. On manifolds, we know exactly how the spectrum of heat kernel decays. Peter talked about that. We have very precise estimates. And essentially, the decay rate has to do with the dimensionality of the manifold and the volume of the manifold in terms of constants. Now, if the spectrum decays, like if the spectrum of the heat kernel, or think of the random walk, one step of the random walk decays like this, then the spectrum of three steps of the random walk, or the heat kernel time three, decays even more, because the spectrum of t to the third is the spectrum of t cubed. And so the spectrum decays even more. If we take higher and higher power, the spectrum decays more and more. Now, all the computations that we're going to do have a fixed precision. Let's fix that once for all. This is a second epsilon, different from the epsilon you're going to ask me about eventually. And it's going to be the precision of my computations. So I fix that. Here I fix it to 0.1 just so I could plot in the graph. It could be 3 digits, 4 digits, 10 digits. And then I look at where this line intersects the spectrum. And I say, well, let's look at the spectrum of t. Whatever is up here, and this x-axis is indexing the eigenvalues, but I can also think of it as indexing the eigenfunctions. So I can think that here there is maybe the 16th eigenfunction, the 17th eigenfunction, the 20th, the 25th, and the 30th. And I say, well, when I do one step with random walk, all those eigenfunctions are essentially dead, where dead means they are below my precision. I want to throw them away. And then if I do two more steps, so I get to t to the third, more eigenfunctions die, in the sense that they fall below my prefixed precision, and I form them all, and I keep doing that. So what do I get? This is just a definition for a chain of subspaces, a subspace B1, which is spanned by all the eigenfunctions up to this index, and this index is defined as the largest eigenvalue that survives one step of the random walk. I do two more steps, and I get B2, which is the subspace spanned by all the eigenfunctions up to 12, and so on. This is completely classical in harmonic analysis. This is a low-pass filter, if you want, of the operator. In fact, it's an exact low-pass filter in the way I defined it. And you could modify that. You could do all sorts of other things. Now, we have a beautiful orthonormal basis for these subspaces. These subspaces, by definition, are spanned by all the eigenfunctions up to here, up to there, up to here, and they're nested. But in a certain sense, we want to change those bases. We want bases for the same subspace, but that they are nicely localized. Okay? So we want to, if you want, do a rotation in that subspace that maps, that gives us another, say, orthonormal basis of nicely localized elements.
Why do we want to do that?
Why we want them localized?
Yeah.
I did a very poor job before, but so I want them localized because I can, for doing function approximation, we need elements at different scales.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to construct those elements at different scales, and then I'm going to show you that several things. First of all, I think that I should have already convinced you that if I have elements at different scales, I can do functional representation much better. That's the example of the decay of the Fourier coefficients versus Wave. And the other thing is, when we look at these eigenfunctions, these are global parameters. Exactly like in BCM we discussed the other days, often we don't have an interpretation for that. If we have local parameterization, we will see that these actually are meaningful, or have a much better chance of being meaningful local elements.
Are you going to show a picture of a band-limited function on
So, okay, so those are going to be our subspaces, lower and lower frequency subspaces, and we're going to build bases for approximately these subspaces. This is very related to what Stefan was doing in his previous talk. He essentially built... He was building characteristic functions that were spanning approximately these subspaces, and he could bound these approximately. I'm going to do a very picky construction in which I say, I want to control this approximately exactly. I want to say, you ask me for a certain number of digits, I want to guarantee you that I'm going to span exactly the subspace up to that arrow. So my subspace could have little tails, but they are bounded by the precision. And the functions that we're going to construct are not necessarily characteristic functions, but they're nice and smooth. And these have huge advantages in approximations, related to actually your comment about R basis versus non-R basis for approximations of these smooth functions. Now, so how can one do that? Well, there is one scheme which is simple but not efficient, but I want to go through that for pedagogical reasons. I think it's the only thing that I would really like to explain why. What is Vj? According to this definition, this Vj is the effective range of the operator t to the 2 to the j, pretty much. Okay? Because by definition, it's Vj, say V4, is everything that hasn't died when I look at the range of t to the 15. So I could look at the matrix T, was our Hilbert kernel, think of it as the as the diffusion of a document graph. And I look at the diffusion at time 2 to the j minus 1. And I want to factor that matrix. This is very similar to what Mike Mahoney discussed yesterday from a partially different but partially similar perspective. It wasn't taking powers, so just at t, if you want. Here, the key is to look at different powers of this matrix. So I look at the diffusion at time 1, and I try to factor that diffusion in terms of some basis elements that I call bj. Each column of bj is a set of documents. And t tilde j is telling me how to combine those documents in order to get the columns of t to the j minus 1. Think also of the talk about non-negative matrix factorizations. There you were looking at some matrix and you were factorizing it as a part of two positive matrices. Here, I'm not forcing positivity on the matrices. I'm saying I want a product in which I have some basis elements, which are representing the matrix as columns, and I can reconstruct any column of this matrix, which is a diffused BAM, by taking linear combinations of these basis elements. And that's encoded in the matrix T tilde J. So is it clear what bj and t tilde j represent? So the columns of bj's are the basis elements, and t tilde j reconstruct the columns of t to the j minus 1 as linear combinations of these basis elements. Now, and I'm doing this up to precision epsilon. Now, when I do that up to precision epsilon, the matrix bj is going to be n, where n is the number of documents that I have, it's the dimension of the space, times some nj, which is the dimension of the space vj. The dimension of the space vj is much smaller than n. N is here, this dimension of v4 is down there, okay? Because we're a low-pass filter. So the matrix bj is n by nj, and then t tilde j is nj by n to reconstruct all the columns of t tilde j minus 1. This is related to the downsampling that Mike was talking about yesterday. This is not really downsampling. I have several choices on how to do this factorization. Two interesting choices are, well, the first one is I might want to force bj to be orthogonal. So I would like my little wave to be orthogonal. And this as motivations mainly numerical analysis. Or I might want bj to be nice and positive. We talked yesterday about the fact that if we have nice positive functions, these bj's are going to really look like little positive bumps of related documents or related words. And I'm going to show you examples. If they're positive, well, we might have a probabilistic interpretation for them. We don't have the usual oscillations that will be induced if I try to orthogonalize these elements. So you can think both ways. Yesterday, Mike, I think, talked about the case in which I pick bj as being a subset of the columns of t to the 2 to the j minus 1. So those are really heat bumps, and I'm trying to write all the possible heat bumps represented in this matrix as a linear combination of a subset of them. That can certainly be done, and it can be done in a very numerically stable way. I'm not considering randomized algorithms here. Or you could enforce orthogonalization, and then you use more algorithms like sparse scale factorizations, and so which were mentioned yesterday, by the way. Now, observe that in this step, we are compressing. We are compressing because bj, as I mentioned before, we have only nj bj's. So the number of basis elements is decreasing with every scale. But we are not quite compressing as much as we could. And there is a construction that says, well, why don't you represent this t tilde j, which is essentially the operator t to the j minus 1 represented on bj in the domain, why don't you represent it with respect to bj also in the range? And you can do that, and you get a much more symmetric and compressed construction. So you say, I diffuse one step, and I compress my diffusion. I compress the range of the diffusion, and I represent my diffusion on this basis in the domain in the range, and you keep doing that. I have a picture that illustrates that, but that I would like to talk about and then take questions, because there is a it can look complicated, but it's not. So at every scale, I have a bunch of, think of it as bumps, as heat bumps, groups of related documents at that scale, and I diffuse them. When I diffuse them, they overlap a lot. This is a redundant basis if I look at look at it up to precision epsilon. There is much redundancy here. So an algorithm looks at this set of bumps and says, oh, this is too redundant. I don't need all these heat kernels to spend the same subspace, which is going to be my next VJ. I discard a portion of those, and I retain only the ones that I really need. And I write the ones that I really need as linear combinations of the bumps that I had at the previous scale. This is exactly what happens in standard wavelets. You write scaling functions at the next coarser scale as linear combination of scaling functions at the previous scale. And this allows you to have a multi-scale constructions and fast algorithms for computing these expansions. So I wanted to get very concrete and actually do a couple of examples and then take questions. So for example, oops. So we saw the other day how the eigenfunctions on the dumbbell looked like. There were this like sine and cosine on the dumbbell. These functions are completely different. They're nice and localized. Again, here the manifold is the dumbbell, and the color is proportional to the value of the function of some scaling functions and wavelets in the dumbbell. And they're nice and localized. They have different scales. This is as fat as the first portion of the bell in the dumbbell. This is at the finer scale. This one is localized right in the middle. And some others have coarser scales and oscillate. These are orthogonal elements. And you can do very nice compression and denoising for functions on, say, on the sphere. I want to do this example because it's similar to the discontinuous triangle I showed you before. You can take a sphere and then the characteristic function of the wedge. And if you try to compress it on Fourier, it's a disaster. That's what you get by retaining something like 200 Fourier coefficients. If you retain 50 wavelet coefficients, that's what you get. So you can represent the information in a much better fashion. What about documents? So, and then I'd really like to have some time for questions. So this is again the science news data sets embedded with the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. Why do I use them? Just to show a picture. Otherwise, I couldn't show you a picture of the data set in 10,000 dimensions. And so each point there is a document. And the color here is proportional to the value of some of the scaling functions that I beat. The scaling functions are little bumps on the set. And there is an optimal number of them and other things. But I can look at the scaling functions. So one is completely concentrated here, one is concentrated there, some other here, here, and there. And then you can look at the documents which are in the support of the scaling functions and see whether this scaling function has a meaning, is a feature that is useful. And so I looked at some of them. I don't know, phi 3, 4, which is the scaling function as scale 3 in position 4 on the set, is about mathematics. I had labels for these documents, so it's purely about mathematics. But if you actually look at it carefully and you look at the documents, it's not about generic random documents in mathematics. It's about particular applications of mathematics, in particular to network and to encryptions and number theory. So very specific and related topics. And then you look at phi 3 10. It's all about astronomy, but very particular sub-branches in astronomy, X-ray cosmology, black holes, and galaxies, all very tightly related. And if I go at coarser scales, these bumps merge into fatter bumps, which are less specific groups of documents. So, well, if I had two scaling functions, I didn't write them down, but if I look at two scaling functions about mathematics, those might merge and become part of a unique scaling function about mathematics. So as I get coarser and coarser, I get scaling functions which are about broader and broader topics. And I have a hierarchical relationship between all these scaling functions. I can tell you exactly how these scaling functions at every scale combine to generate the next coarser topics. On top of that, this algorithm also yields, or this construction, I should say, also yields a representation of how the topics interact with each other. How do we measure this interaction? Well, that's exactly how to measure the interaction between two topics. I look at this topic, at these topics. These are two functions on the set. I diffuse them at their time scale. This is the operator T2 to the J that we compressed and represent on these bumps. And so these measure how much the topics interact. So I could get a picture in which all the topics are represented, and they're represented faithfully in the sense that their connections are correctly weighted by the diffusions between these two topics. So two topics in mathematics will have strong diffusion among themselves, and the topic in mathematics and earth science will have a very small diffusion. that's already been computed and encoded at the correct scale. Observe that the correct scale is crucial, because if you have two topics and you diffuse once, they're not going to interact. They're going to interact when you diffuse the correct number of times so that they really talk to each other. And these dyadic powers of T told me exactly which time scale I should look at and which groups exist and talk to each other. And so here are other examples of scaling functions. These are the titles of the documents in the support of these functions. And then I can look at the words that are most characterizing for that group in order to build, say, a short summary of that group. And so here everything I think makes sense, but there are some cases in which I get scaling functions which are cross topics, which actually, some of them are actually really interesting, because you see the crossbreeding between sciences and some others. And so you have documents in the support of the scaling functions and the corresponding work. Of course, you could play the same game by looking not at the graph of documents, but at the graph of words as they relate within the document corpus. And you can do the same multi-scale analysis. And you can look at scaling functions and wavelets of words. And these are little folders of words which are topics, maybe. Or I don't have the correct language probably to be talking about these things. But for example, one of such scaling functions is about university science study team group on psychology, ordered with respect to order or importance inside the scaling function, and so on. And you could even take a document, which is a function of the words, and write it as a combination of topics at different scales.
So we use those things as features. Right?
You can reuse those things as features. And you see, if I looked at eigenfunctions, I wouldn't get this. This eigenfunction would be spread out over the set, but this is a feature. This is very related to what you did with k-means. Those are local. You can think of each cluster found by k-means as the characteristic function of,
mm-hmm.
of the cluster.
Mm-hmm.
Here, these functions have weights. They decay smoothly. They're like little heat bumps.
Well, k-means can do that.
Can assign probabilities.
Yeah.
Yes. But the point is that these are weighted as the diffusion process weights them.
Right.
So I don't have to introduce any, say, model that justifies
right.
why should I assign this weight based on k-means. I just said, the only thing that I'm given is the diffusion, and then
when that
automatically commands.
And that
the
it
kind
of introduce whatever model you have.
Right.
You introduce the model implicitly.
Implicitly, exactly. Exactly.
So how good are these?
Sorry?
How good are these?
Look?
I'm not sure what good means.
Right?
Sorry, that's the question. What is good?
I'm not sure what good means. That's that ties to my remark that I don't know how to define meaningful.
Well, there's a simple experiment that we ran, which is using those as features for representing documents. And if you do that and you re-embed the documents that you get, you see that you get a better separation between the manually assigned labels.
Okay.
So that's one hint.
In other words, these are good when used as these clusters are good when used as features for text classification.
Right. Well, but I think he's saying for the same data set.
Yes.
So, I mean, we don't have another data set. That
so
would be
two-step
process.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Another. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you can always. This is unsupervised, right? So you can always run another test set.
You could, right? But I don't think they have.
No, we don't.
Right, because we didn't give them another set of data. Because we don't have.
Yeah, another observation, which could be a definition of good, and this has popped out in our talks, is, you know, when do you say that you have understood something or you have found some information and so on? When, you know, this is tied to notions of sparseness, without going too much into the details. So I did the experiment of taking a document and writing as a linear combination of these concepts. And this representation is always extremely sparse. And that there are even mathematical reasons why that should happen. In a certain sense, it's almost enforced in a hidden way by the construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so this means that these are pretty good explanations or building elements for the documents. And the same thing holds dually to explain these concepts in terms of documents and groups of documents in which they appear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
But it's not a...
Because they look good, and if I play the advocate's devil and I see smoke nicotine cigarette, that's good, and then I see Neanderthal, that must be an error because Neanderthalers had no cigarettes.
Yeah,
yeah.
By
teeth.
Cavity and teeth.
Which is very important.
So these are actually sorted by order of.
It depends on.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
I have no hard claim on.
Yeah. I have a nice mathematical approach, which is very
well. But the idea is also that it lets you see an organization that you couldn't find otherwise,
mm-hmm.
because it's organizing your hierarchically in a completely, if you want, principled way, in the sense that the only element that I used is the initial diffusion. So once you believe that, that's it. There is only one construction that gives you the multiscale analysis, and you have all these connections between. Say words and documents, and groups of documents at different scales. So you have both a hierarchy, the duality of words, documents. If you had a function that you wanted to learn, say you label some of the documents, you can expand those in terms of these functions. The noise that in the semi-supervised learning algorithm. It seems to work okay, but I have no comparison with this data set for that task. So, yes.
Do you have a picture of bandwidth function? Don't you somewhere? I may have totally screwed up your laptop. It can be extended on.
I do have it in.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to talk about the supervised?
No, it's. I think it's.
To extend in a function.
Right. It's a very valuable picture to see.
Oh, yeah, I have your picture.
Because I think it's a very valuable picture because one needs justification.
Sorry, this is from the paper. Can I zoom? Oh, I see how it was. But this is a very long story, Peter. Is this what you talk about? So I take a function on the set and I try to extend it in a band limited fashion.
Okay, I was actually thinking of a picture of a semi-spiral thing and function on it extends.
Yes, I can draw a picture of the board.
Okay. So somebody in Yale has this picture. Right?
Okay, but maybe not me.
No, green and red. Okay, sorry.
So, yeah, I should probably stop. But I just wanted to mention very briefly that the same thing can be done on images. Actually, Arthur is going to give more to talk about this.
Evocative comments.
Yes.
So there's a great line of Peter Lacks, which I cannot do justice, which is that if you want to see an object, you shouldn't use a thermometer, you should use a flashlight. And so that's a way of saying, okay, great, you know everything about the heat equation, but it's totally irrelevant for looking at an object, you should use the weight. Now, so there are forces, there's a deep connection between the heat equation and the wave equation, and even numerically there's this beautiful history where you have first fast wavelet solvers and then these lead to an understanding of fast Laplace solvers,
yeah.
And then Michelson figures out by looking basically at the guts of those algorithms how to do fast wave solvers, and that's
mm-hmm.
an amazing accomplishment.
Yes.
Do you think there's a theory of the wave equation so that we don't have to feel our waves going around blindly, but we can kind of flashlight.
But so people have looked at wave equations on graphs.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a wave equation. I'm not
saying so
that's the right thing.
So what really bothers me is that so I'm not sure that I could use that. I'm not sure how I would extract information. You know, because of the mixing properties, it would seem extremely hard to, which is of course at the core of Boston America.
Sure.
Right, well, so I'm going, yes.
Suppose I come to you and I say, hey, I have this document from Science News that I forgot to give you.
Yes, okay, yes. So that's that was exactly Peter's question. So
as Peter's question filtered through seven semesters of graduate counseling.
Right. So when is that question I think really meaningful? Is when the new document kind of fits in together with the other documents in some way. So if I had that feature, but document wouldn't end up 10 miles away from my set, but it's roughly the similar to that set. Now, you can measure the similarity between that document. Once it comes in, you can measure the similarity between that document and the other ones that you have. And so now you can diffuse to it. And so you can extend the eigenfunctions and just extend the diffusion wavelets and perfect sense that it's consistent. Now, when the new point comes in, that really changes the geometry of the graph. So if just a new point comes in, it's a small perturbation. And one can bound pretty precisely how much that is going to perturb the eigenfunctions. But those technically change. Now, if you come with a body of document which is larger than what I started with, like the experience that you did yesterday, where suppose you didn't have a strong at the beginning that you put it in, then the change in the geometry of the document spaces change considerably. And you can update the geometry as the points get added. And that's kind of the only way that one can do that.
So if I want to know something about the document that say it's honestly from Science News, just one thing about, so pretty similar. I still need to actually have all of those other documents sitting around to do the similarity, or I have to have some model of similarity.
You need to compare it to the corpus that you already have.
Right.
So one of the key aspects that we haven't touched upon, but it's extremely important, is how do you construct these graphs? So you don't want to compute n-square similarities, and this is related to a new point comes in. I want to know almost immediately which documents are going to be close by. I don't want to check all of them. And how to do that, and it's a very difficult problem. It's a very simple problem that I mentioned, but we have experts here.
I'm embarrassed that the picture I was referring to is, of course, in Stefan's.
The tube with his name?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so let me conclude the talk. So